Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Blessed holiday to you. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana. Spending my last few hours here at Holden Village at the end of 3 weeks of teaching Bible studies and theology of the cross. And today is a special session not related to anything else I've been doing. Which I think I called on the kiosk Yankee Doodle David. It's just a session on a biblical view of nation building, because today we're recalling how our forebears pulled our country together as a nation, or at least tried. To me, Saturday morning classes have the feel of detention. I never went to a school that had Saturday morning or any Saturday classes, although the university at which I teach did have them up until around the time I came there. But I once had a whole month of Saturday morning detention for turning out the lights in the main building of the school during a faculty meeting. I didn't know that was going on, or I'd have had second thoughts. But so I know what my crime was. I don't know what you did. But welcome to Saturday morning study hall. Because we're remembering our forebears who risked and worked and did all sorts of other things to get this nation started, I thought one more time I would bring my anguished English book and read some odd views of these things that were written apparently by school children. No one person got the history of the United States this mixed up. This is a compilation, I'm sure. So I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs from this book, which is a collection of ways that the English language has been misunderstood, misused, and abused in various ways. One of the causes of the Revolutionary War was the English put tax in their tea. Also, the colonists would send their parcels through the post without stamps. During the war, the Redcoats and Paul Revere was throwing balls over stone walls. The dogs were barking and peacocks crowing. Finally, the colonists won the war and no longer had to pay for taxis. Delegates from the original 13 states formed the Contented Congress. Thomas Jefferson, a virgin, and Benjamin Franklin were two signers of the Declaration of Independence. Franklin had gone to Boston carrying all his clothes in his pocket and a loaf of bread under each arm. He invented electricity by rubbing two cats backwards and declared, "A horse divided against itself cannot stand." Franklin died in 1790 and is still dead. George Washington married Martha Curtis and in due time became the father of our country. His farewell address was Mount Vernon. Soon the Constitution of the United States was adopted to secure domestic hostility. Under the Constitution, the people enjoyed the right to keep bare arms. All right, that's enough. I thought that in honor of Independence Day, we could look at a biblical history of a not all that dissimilar set of circumstances. How Israel became a nation as distinct from a nomadic enslaved people or a loosely knit group of tribes who didn't like each other much more than they like the Moabites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Uzzites, and all the other ites that were around them and keep showing up in the Bible. We're going to take a flying trip through a portion of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, And we're going to be inside the larger work that is known in biblical studies as the Deuteronomistic history. I said this phrase a couple times in my Bible study a couple weeks ago and thoroughly confused a few people. And they wanted to know what this was. The Deuteronomistic history is simply the name scholars have given to the material that stretches through the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, or what we call 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. It's the story of Israel's life in the land. The book of Joshua is the story of their taking the land, and the book of 2 Kings ends with their losing the land. So the whole stretch from taking to losing the land was a historical survey put together by someone after they had lost the land. Using all sorts of older documents, every once in a while, whoever this was, stops to tell you, if you'd like to read more about this king, you can look it up in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. Or you could look it up in the book of Yeshar. Oh, and there are a couple of other books that this person mentions. So this is actual, you know, historiography going on here. This is someone who had sources, who tells us what a few of them were, and puts together the story of Israel's life in the land. The reason that it's called the Deuteronomistic history is because everyone in the whole story is judged on how well they did or didn't comply with the laws that appear in the book of Deuteronomy. And so whoever wrote this had a very clear perspective on how you evaluated what was going on in the people's lives. And oddly enough, the book of Deuteronomy dates from a rather late part of this era, which we might think is a bit unfair to judge people who never heard of or read the book of Deuteronomy by the book of Deuteronomy. But we don't have time to go into that peculiar mystery. The book of Deuteronomy was found in the temple, and no one had ever seen it before, only about 20 years before the loss of everything. Only about 20 years before the exile did they come upon this thing. But this writer judges everyone by whether or not they followed it, because he believes they should have known. So that's a bit strange, but we don't have time for that mystery this morning. We're going to start at the end of the book of Judges. The book of Judges tells the story of the approximately two centuries between the Exodus, the end of the Exodus and the entry into the land, and the end of the period that we call the period of the Judges, or others call the Tribal Confederation. The Israelites came out of the wilderness, according to the story, moved into the land. Some accounts in Joshua say that they took the entire land and exterminated everybody who was in their way. Other places say that they sort of moved in, conquered some territories, didn't conquer others, and just sort of settled where they could and mingled in with the population of the Canaanites and all those other ites. And the latter story is obviously closer to the truth. They did not exterminate everyone, as some texts say, because as we know, all sorts of these other ites were still around all the time and caused all manner of trouble. In fact, even the city of Jerusalem was not an Israelite city until a point at which we'll see today. David takes the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites and makes it into his capital. The period of the Judges is a time when Israel experienced periodic oppression, and charismatic leaders, who we call judges, rose up to rally them against their enemies. They would thrive for a while, then fall back into oppression, and this cycle just seems to have repeated itself over and over and over again. At the end of the book, there's this positively terrifying story. In fact, it's the premiere story in a book called Texts of Terror. There's a story here in the end of the book of Judges about a Levite who shoved his concubine, which is a particular kind of wife, out into a crowd of deranged men who spent the night abusing her, left her dead on the doorstep, and in the morning he goes out, sees her body on the threshold and says, it's time to get up and go. And when she doesn't move, he's outraged that somebody has killed his concubine. He cuts her body into 12 pieces, sends one piece to each one of the tribes of Israel and says, look what the Benjaminites did to my concubine. Let's get vengeance on the Benjaminites. And so a bunch of people rally around this guy and practically wipe out the Benjaminites to the point that they have to actually volunteer to give up some people from each of their tribes to reconstitute the tribe of Benjamin. This is just a vicious, awful, terrible story. And the Deuteronomistic historian says at the end of this in Judges 21:25, in those days there was no king in Israel. All the people did what was right in their own eyes. And after you've read what I've just summarized for you, you say, no kidding. That's what it looked like. There was chaos. These tribes were just as likely to fight with each other as with anybody else. Then we get, the book of Ruth is not part of the Deuteronomistic history. It was inserted later by Christian, in the Christian canon this book appears here. In the Jewish canon this book appears in the writings, among the miscellaneous books that were the last into the canon. The Deuteronomistic history continues in 1 Samuel with the birth of Samuel to Hannah, and this is one of those remarkable births. Samuel was an important enough figure in the history of Israel that we needed to know his birth narrative. If you are really, truly important enough in Israel, we have to know the circumstances of your birth. And Samuel is one of those people. Among other things, he was the great transitional figure between the tribal confederation and the nation. He was a military leader of sorts, if you read his story carefully, but he was also a prophet. He's the prophet who, as we'll see, anoints the first two kings. So we get his story in the first three chapters, and the story then that I want to focus on and play with for a while is a piece of the Deuteronomistic history that this narrator during the exile, who's writing the history of life in the land, got from somewhere. Scholars call it the Ark narrative. It's the history of the travels of the Ark of the Covenant. And it's a wonderful story. This is the kind of story, as you'll see, we can imagine the Israelites telling children for both educational and entertainment purposes. One thing you always need to remember about the Bible is that it wasn't only what we would think of as sacred literature for the ancient people. This was their entertainment too. They would do these stories for the young people, and this Ark narrative you'll see in particular works great for this. They did this story for their young people just like what y'all are going to do tonight over in the Village Center for the 4th of July. They would entertain themselves with this story. 1 Samuel 4. In those days the Philistines mustered for war against Israel, and Israel went out to battle against them. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek, and the Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle was joined, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. When the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord put us to rout today before the Philistines? Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh so that he may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. Well, there's quite an idea. Let's bring God out here to the battle. Well, where was God? I've been doing theology of the cross, starting with that question. Where is God? Well, the answer to that question in these days was, let's read just a little bit further, maybe. So the people went to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, who is enthroned on the cherubim. That's where God is, enthroned on the cherubim. Cherubim were bulls with usually human faces and wings, and sometimes other odd features. There are cherubim. Cherub is the singular, cherubim is the plural. There are cherubim in the art and literature of many of the ancient peoples of the Near East. You can see huge cherub figures in Chicago at the Oriental Institute, where archaeologists of previous generations were able to get them out of the archaeological sites in Babylon and elsewhere and bring them to the United States, and they're massive things. But on the Ark of the Covenant were two rather small ones. And what cherub figures, cherubim, what they were figures on which gods rode. Baal, the god of the Canaanites, cruised around in the skies on a cherub. So this is just the way the ancients pictured gods and how they located themselves. And Israel believed that Yahweh was enthroned on the cherubim that sat atop the Ark of the Covenant. So where is God? There. And the Ark of the Covenant had been left in the northern city of Shiloh after the Exodus, and it was tended to by some priest-like figures, even though there was no formal big cult, there was no temple, there was not anything like that, there was no big class of priests or any such thing at this time. There were just these folks at Shiloh who took care of this wonderfully sacred thing, the Ark of the Covenant. So I often use this line when I teach this, and I did a couple weeks ago here, this business of where is God, and God is in this one specific place according to the ancients. It always reminds me of my wife's grandfather's grave in Chesterton, Indiana. On his tombstone it says, "Everybody's got to be someplace." And his wife's right next to it says, "Patience." She needed a lot. But the ancients believed this of everyone, including the deity. The deity had to be someplace, and this is where Yahweh was. There wasn't yet an idea of omnipresence. Those ideas were a long way off. Still in the history even of Israel. Okay, anyway. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. When the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" When they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "Oh no, the gods have come into the camp." They also said, "Woe to us, nothing like this ever happened before. Oh no, way day. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage, O men of Philistines, in order not to become slaves to the Hebrews as they've been to you. Be men and fight. So a little warrior rally speech here. So the Philistines fought. Israel was defeated, and they fled, everyone to his home. There was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. This is not what you expect when they haul Yahweh out to the battle. Yahweh was supposed to come out there and help them, save them from the Philistines, but oh no, we are defeated and the Ark is lost. A quick sidelight, a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and earth upon his head. And when he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching. His heart trembled for the Ark of God. When the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. And when Eli heard the sound of the outcry, he said, "What is this uproar?" The man came quickly and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old. His eyes were set so that he could not see. The man said to Eli, "I've just come from the battle. I fled from the battle today." He said, "How did it go, son?" The messenger said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there's been a great slaughter. Your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. The Ark is captured." When he mentioned the Ark of God, not the sons, or not the defeat, but when he mentioned the Ark, that finally was too much. And Eli fell over backwards from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. He was an old man and heavy. So when he fell over, that was it. He judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth. When she heard the news that the Ark was captured and her father-in-law and husband dead, she bowed and gave birth. Her labor pains overwhelmed her, and as she was about to die, she's going to die in childbirth from this event, the woman attending her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer or give heed. And what we can hear here, if you know the whole story of Israel, is these are very close to the words of an earlier narrator who tells the story of Rachel dying in childbirth out on the road near Bethlehem. And that is remembered through the history of Israel as one of the most tragic deaths ever. This is couched in the same language in order to give us a sense of the tragedy here. She did not answer or give heed. She named the child Ichabod, meaning the glory has left, because the Ark of God has been captured, and because of her father-in-law and husband. The glory has departed from Israel, the Ark of God is captured. Okay, so a terrible, tragic day for Israel. An unexpected tragedy, because we thought the Ark would save us. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. The Philistines took the Ark and brought it into the house of Dagon, a Philistine deity, and placed it beside Dagon. When the people, I don't know what they thought this meant, you know, we're not told that, like we're going to now have a committee of gods working together or something, who knows. The people of, why didn't they just destroy it? In any case, when they rose the next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And the language is Dagon falling into the posture of worshiping before the Ark of the Covenant. Now, this is when the children begin to laugh. So, you don't have to laugh, but this is when the story begins to have comic overtones for the listeners on the night of the 4th. So they took Dagon and set him back up. When they rose the next morning, Dagon had fallen on his face before the Ark again. And the head of Dagon and his hands were lying cut off upon the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not step on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. They still remember this, kids. The hand of the Lord was heavy upon the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and struck them with tumors, both in Ashdod and in its territory. And when the inhabitants of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is heavy upon us and on our god Dagon." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "What shall we do with the Ark of the Covenant?" The inhabitants of Gath replied, "Let it be moved on." So they moved the Ark to Gath. But after they had brought it to Gath, the hand of the Lord was heavy against that city, causing great panic. So they moved it to Ekron. And when it came to Ekron, the people said, "Why are you bringing it here? We don't want that thing here." So they gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Just send it away, get rid of it, let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For a deadly panic was all through the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. Those who didn't die were stricken with tumors, and everybody's crying out to the heavens. Can you see what's going on here?
God's supposed to be crazy.
Well, something like that. Just to preview what the point is here, what the Israelites did was an act of holy war. You bring God out to the battle so that God will fight your battle for you. So they bring the ark out so that this is no longer just a skirmish with the Philistines, but now we've got a holy war. And it doesn't work. They lose, and they lose the ark. But now do you see what the ark is doing all on its own without benefit of Hophni and Phinehas or anybody else? Now the ark on its own is waging holy war against the Philistines. Everywhere it goes, it puts them to the rout, and they're just terrified, which is what's supposed to happen in the presence of this thing, just like the Philistines were initially. So now, without benefit of Israelite carriers, it's waging holy war all by itself. The ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. The Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What do we do with it? Tell us what we should send with it to its place." So the diviners decide that they need to fill the thing with treasure to take care of all their guilt. So they fill the thing with gold, it looks like in the Hebrew that they make gold examples of their tumors, sort of on the, like the, remember the bronze snake they made out in the wilderness, the Israelites? Apparently people thought that if you made representations of the things that were hurting you, somehow you could gain control of these things. So they make make gold representations of the tumors and 5 gold mice. I don't know what that's about. I have had mice in my room, but it didn't occur to me to make gold mice to chase them away. But in any case, they fill this thing with all this stuff, and then verse 7, they get ready a new cart and 2 milk cows that have never borne a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them. This is the directions for what to do. Take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart and put it in a box at its side, the figures of gold which you are returning as a guilt offering, then send it off and let it go its way. And watch, if it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand, that is Yahweh's hand, that has struck us. It's happened by chance. So they did this. They took 2 milk cows, yoked them to the cart, shut their calves at home, put the ark of the Lord on the cart, put the box with the gold mice and the images of their tumors. The cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. So this is another time the children laugh. Here's the Ark of the Covenant tied to two cows that are headed for Beth Shemesh. Straight to the place which they've decided is the sign that yes, indeed, it was Yahweh who was besieging us, and this was no accident. Now, the Philistines are finally rid of this thing. The people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. When they looked up and saw the ark, they went with rejoicing to meet it. You know, so apparently, I guess it was easily recognizable. But, what a sight this must be. Here comes the ark cruising along on its own behind a couple of cows. The cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stopped there. A large stone was there, so they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the Ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the gold objects, and so forth. And the five lords of the Philistines had kept watch over this process to make sure that the thing left. So they're satisfied. They return home to Ekron. And then we get an accounting of the gold tumors and so forth. And then verse 19, the descendants of Jeconiah did not rejoice with the people of Beth Shemesh when they greeted the Ark of the Lord. And so the Lord killed 70 of them. The people mourned because the Lord had made a great slaughter among the people. I mean, all they did was have a party and somebody didn't quite get it. So, slaughter. The people of Beth Shemesh said, "Who's able to stand before the Lord, the Holy God? To whom shall he go that we may be rid of him?" So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have returned the Ark of the Lord. Come down and take it." You know, it's like, have I got a deal for you? How would you like to buy an ark? You know, we're not. They didn't say the part about it's been slaughtering people here. So the people of Kiriath Jearim came and took the Ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. They consecrated the son of Eleazar to have charge of the Ark. From the day that the Ark was lodged at Kiriath Jearim, a long time passed, 20 years. And all the house of the Lord lamented, all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. So, and that's the first section of this thing called the Ark narrative. There's one more chapter later on. What does this mean? Because I want to get farther, I'm not going to let this open for discussion. The Ark proves that it is in charge of itself. They thought they could haul Yahweh out to do their battle for them. And the ark chose to let them get defeated. But the minute it's out of their control, it starts doing its own holy war. And in fact, even when it gets back to their territory, it starts picking on them. The moral of the story is you can't haul God around in a box and make God do your bidding. God will do what God jolly well pleases. And wage war against whoever it wants to. You cannot control God in the way that you think. That's at least one thing that this much of the story teaches. And that will be very important for something that happens later, to know that you cannot manipulate the ark. The ark does what it wants. And if it doesn't like where it is, it'd just soon kill you as look at you. Okay, and when I say the ark, I really mean Yahweh. You can't haul Yahweh around like your pet and say, "Sick 'em, Yahweh!" Get our enemies. Yahweh is not your attack dog. Well, this brings us to the point when the Israelites realize they need some change in their life. This business of the judges has worked okay, but they've been whomped up on so many times they're sick and tired of it. So in 1 Samuel 8, we get a remarkable new development. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, the name of the second Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not follow in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. So we know the story in Chicago. You know, Mayor Bailey was honest, but his son, no. That was supposed to be a facetious comment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "You're old, your sons are crooks. Appoint for us a king to serve us, or to govern us." And now this line would make Hebrew, not just kids, laugh. "Like other nations." In Hebrew, it's like the goyim. And you would still get a laugh with that today. "We want to be like the goyim," you know, the Gentiles. "Give us a king." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king." So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Well, listen to the voice of the people and all that they say to you. They haven't rejected you, they've rejected me. So don't take this personally, Samuel. They're rejecting you just like they rejected me from being king over them." So this is interpreted by God as the rejection of theocracy. God is their only ruler. God is their king. And now they want a regular king like the nations have. "Just like they did to me from the day I brought them out of Egypt to today, forsaking me and serving other gods, now they're going to do the same to you, Samuel." So listen to their voice, but solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king, and he said, "This will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He'll take your sons and appoint them to his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties." So the first thing that'll happen when you get a king is the military draft, because the king will need a standing army, and the king will take not just recruit, but take your young men to do this military service. "And some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and equipment of his chariots." So now you got the military-industrial complex. Not just the military, but all the supporting industry that it takes to equip and maintain the army. "He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers." So it's not just your men he's going to take. Kings have a certain lifestyle, you know. They need to smell nice and eat well. So your daughters are going to have to be taken too to provide for the king. "He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He'll take 1/10 of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and courtiers." So this is the IRS. This is taxation. It costs a lot of money to have the army and the industry that supports the army and this nice lifestyle for the king. So get ready to send a good share of what you have for the king. "He'll take your male and female slaves, the best of your cattle, put them to his work. He'll take 1/10 of your flocks, and you will become his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king who you chose for yourselves, and the Lord isn't gonna listen." So go ahead, have a king if you want. This is what it'll do. But remember, please, it's your king. And when you get sick of this, the Lord will just say, that's what you wanted. Enjoy. The people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, no. We are determined to have a king over us, so that we may be like the other nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. So when Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. See, the Lord is someplace, and the Lord doesn't necessarily hear the conversation, so Samuel has to report to the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, go ahead, listen to their voice. Give them a king. So Samuel says, okay, everybody go home, I'll figure this out. So this is the Deuteronomistic historian's judgment on kings. It was the stupidest idea ever to have kings. God thought it was apostasy, and God hated the whole idea, but some kind of necessary evil, because the people were going to do it, and regardless of what God wanted. So this is destined to be a misery and a curse upon us to have kings. That is the opinion of the Deuteronomistic historian. And at the end of the story, 2 Kings 23 is going to say, you know why we lost the land? It was the kings. It was finally the kings' sins that caused God to wipe us off the face of the land. But there's another opinion about kings, as we're going to see. In Israel, there were always multiple opinions about everything, just like there are in the United States and every other human civilization. Whenever you read the line, and all Israel said this, or all Israel thought that, be suspicious. You know, even out there in the wilderness, when all Israel was said to do this and all Israel was said to do that, you know how many people were out there? The book of Numbers says it was 600,000 men, not counting the women and children. We're talking about a population of at least 2.5 million people. And if you can imagine 2.5 million people all having precisely the same opinion, then you believe in miracles I can't imagine. In any case, you know, there were parties within this group that hated the whole idea of monarchy. There were the pro-monarchy people, and all kinds of things in between. But whatever what we just read is a preserved piece of the anti-monarchy party within Israel. Well, we're going to have to start marching fast and taking no prisoners here. What Samuel does, I mean, the rest of this story here is also comical in its own way. I mean, if you're going to suddenly have a king, how do you go about picking a king? I mean, this people's never had a king. They've had tribal leaders and stuff like that. So Samuel's got to figure out how to find a king for these people, and it's a bad idea to begin with, so what's he supposed to do? You know, so Samuel starts just going around the people, watching folks, trying to imagine who would make a king. And one day, he sees this tall, handsome guy, the most handsome guy he's ever seen, who stands head and shoulders above everybody around. And he says, wow, maybe that's what a king looks like. Happened to be a young kid named Saul. So he starts following Saul around, this boy. He starts following him around. One day Saul gets sent by his father off into the wilderness to find some lost donkeys. And Samuel catches up with him out there where nobody else can see this. And Samuel sneaks up on Saul and says, Saul, I have a word with you. You're going to be the king. And Saul says, the what? The king, you're going to be the king. Well, what means king? Well, never mind, we'll figure this out. So he anoints him out there by Rachel's tomb, which becomes very important later on in lots of things. that the first king of Israel ever was anointed there. And he said, but now don't tell anybody, because we got to spring this on the people. I mean, I got to figure out how we're going to introduce you, so don't say anything until I tell you. So Saul goes back home, and his dad says, well, did you find the lost donkeys? Saul says, well, no, but I got a secret. Wasn't really a lost trip, you know, but no donkeys. So, I mean, this has got to have been funny for the kids to listen to, you know. The boy who's king, but can't tell anybody, and so forth. Well, eventually, as you know, Saul is introduced. He becomes the king. It's a terrible job to try to unite a people who don't like each other. A bunch of tribes. I mean, this is the equivalent of trying to unite Iraq. This is a tribal culture. Everything revolves around tribal identity. Oh yeah, they said they all sort of united in worshiping Yahweh. But that didn't stop them from practically annihilating the Benjaminites a generation ago. So Saul has an absolutely terrible task ahead of him. How to unite this people. And he gives it a try, and it almost works, but not quite. And among other things, he's got this young whippersnapper with political aspirations named David, a friend of one of his sons, tooling around, doing all sorts of things, gradually through various heroic episodes becoming a hero. Saul in a way admires him and in a way fears him, and this is all some more wonderful stories that are great for reading to kids. It was certainly some of my favorite stuff in the Bible when I was a boy, you know, listening to the exploits of young King David. But in any case, Saul, I mean, this is really complicated, and it would be nice to have a month to teach this up here. Saul has a moment that's prototypical of important people, in which everything goes haywire. He's in a territory away from his home, and he comes to a well, and some women show up. And you know what's supposed to happen when you're outside of your territory and you come to a well and some women show up? This had happened in so many generations. That's where you get your bride. Even Jesus has a story like that. Remember in John 4, he comes to a well and a woman shows up, and all the parts of that story except for actually taking a wife. Yes. But Saul, so he's got one of these stories. He's an important enough figure to have one of these stories. But instead of going ahead and getting water from these women, he says he's looking for the seer. Which way did the seer go? And he said, the women say, went that way. So he goes chasing off. He doesn't find the seer, so he offers sacrifices on his own. And God condemns him and turns his face away from Saul from that moment, and Saul is destroyed. He never again can be God's favorite. So he's ruined. He's a man, he's a tragic figure, a transitional figure. And who becomes his successor when he dies? At the end of 1 Samuel 31, David, this fellow whom secretly Samuel has anointed out in a private place where no one can know. But Saul and his sons fall to the Philistines at the end of chapter 31. A piece of the story that isn't attended to very often is that in 2 Samuel 1 and following, there's a war for succession. David is the appointed heir to the throne, but there are others who want it as well, and there are some battles from which finally David emerges, and David finally becomes king over all Israel by the end of chapter 5. and David's enemies always end up dead, even though he never does it personally. Very clever fellow. And then in chapter 6, we get the rest of the Ark narrative. David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and all the people with him set out and went from Baal Yudah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. They carried the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the Ark of God, and Ahio went in front of the Lord, and David and all the house of Israel were dancing before the Lord with all their might, with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals, and the whole of Holden Village was dancing with them just a couple weeks ago. Never mind. Some of you were there. When they came to the threshing floor of Nakon, Uzzah reached out his hand to the Ark of God and took hold of it, because the oxen shook it, or the oxen stumbled, say the older translations. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him there because he reached out his hand to the Ark, and he died there besides the Ark of God. What in the world? This thing is still so dangerous. Some poor guy is just trying to keep it from falling over. When the oxen stumble, God fries them. You know, this is just mean. David was angry because the Lord burst forth like that against Uzzah. So the place was called Perez Uzzah to this day. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, well, how can the Ark of the Lord come into my care? So David was unwilling to take the Ark of the Lord into his care in the city of David. David had conquered Jerusalem now, and it was called the city of David. It had not been an Israelite city up to this point. So David took it to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, and the Ark remained there for 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom. Aha! Finally, the Ark is starting to bless people instead of fry them or give them tumors and whatnot. So it was told to King David, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the Ark of God. So David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the Ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling, and David danced before the Lord with all his might. David was girded with a linen ephod, so David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. What does this mean? The Ark of the Lord never goes anywhere but what it will do its own bidding, thank you. You cannot make it do what it doesn't want to do. It does what it pleases. And David brought that thing into Jerusalem, and it blessed him. He got away with it, if you will. Which means the Ark wanted to be there. That's what this story says. David couldn't have brought the Ark to Jerusalem successfully and had it not terrorize the city, except that the Ark chose on its own to be content with this move. Now, this is highly political literature. This is the literature of David's people and the people that approved of the Ark's move. To move the Ark of the Covenant, the central symbol of the Exodus people, who mostly lived up north. The Exodus was the sacred relic of the northerners who had been the Exodus people. The southerners down where David lived, they hadn't got in on, they weren't part of the Exodus. They had been annexed over the generations. You know, they weren't real Israelites. They were people that we sort of gradually glommed onto. the pure version of the Israelite people was up north, and these guys stole our ark. I mean, this would be like moving the Liberty Bell to Valparaiso, Indiana, and saying, now it's found a new home. Isn't this wonderful? I don't think Philadelphians would like this. This was a tribal relic as much as anything else. This was a terrible thing to do from the point of view of those people. And you know they're not going to stick with this project very long, don't you? The Northerners lasted two generations in this business. And then they had to find a way to have their own ark again up there. And what you'll remember what they did was they built a cherub in Bethel and a cherub in Dan. One on the far south and one on the far north. So as to say, you think you got a God in a box down there in your Jerusalem temple, our whole country is an ark. That's the meaning of that. Although the Southerners who kept this history said, you know what they're doing up there, worshiping cows. Well, give me a break. If you lost your church, you wouldn't go off and worship cows, right? These were symbols of the presence of the Lord. For now, David is said to have gotten away with moving the presence of Yahweh to Jerusalem and making it his capital. So this is politics. This is how David managed to bring the central symbols of Israel's religious tradition to Jerusalem and get away with it. David was an amazing politician. He picked a neutral city for his that he had conquered from the Jebusites to make his capital. If we had time, we could keep reading here. Let's just look at verse 16. The ark of the Lord came into the city of David. Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window. And you remember how he got Michal, the daughter of Saul, to be his wife? Saul tried to get him killed by saying, one day, no, David, I'll bet you anything you couldn't come in here next week with a bag of 100 Philistine foreskins. You know, and since the Philistines don't donate them willingly, the only way to get them is to go kill 100 Philistines. Well, David shows up with 200. And the bet was, if you do it, I'll give you my daughter. So he's got to give David Michal, his daughter. So Michal had become David's wife on the basis of this bet. Now these were characters. Michal looks out the window and sees this disgusting display, and she scolds David for this, and so David saw to it that she was shut out for the rest of her life. And chapter 6 ends, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. This is not only resolution of a marital dispute, this is the end of Saul's line. So there can't be rivals. I mean, there's other people in Saul's family who are still around, and we're going to have to find a way to get rid of them too. But this is another way to get rid of any possible rivals. Well, this is a story of at least some familiarity to all of us. We want God to be on our side, and we all have our ways of saying that God is on our side. And we like to collect around us, too, the symbols that show that we are the ones of whom God approves. Eventually, as you know, this ark will reside in Jerusalem for several hundred years, but then it will be lost again. And then we'll have to have a new story, because this time it wasn't just taken to the house of the Philistines. It really was lost until Indiana Jones found it. But in the meantime, you know, we had prophets who built for us new kinds of arks. And for that, you have to go back to the prophet Ezekiel and read about the wonderful new ark with its cherubim. And we're out of time, so we can't do that. But that's That's the story of Yankee Doodle David.